It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out why longer lunch periods may encourage kids to eat healthier foods.
First, tomorrow is the official beginning of autumn. Wisconsin is known nationwide for our beautiful fall colors, and lots of people travel to the state to see them.
But there's more to see than just beautiful leaves in the fall. What fun fall festivals are there in your town? What are your Wisconsin fall traditions? Where do you like to travel to see beautiful colors or enjoy the outdoors before winter? Call in now and share your favorite fall destinations at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Stephanie Klett is with us now to talk about fall tourism in Wisconsin. She's the secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Tourism. Stephanie, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, it's great to be with you both.
So, you know, we hear about Vermont, but we've got it pretty good here in Wisconsin when it comes to fall colors, don't we?
We really do. In fact, you know, nationally, you're going to hear really about two places. You're going to hear with our New England area, the six states that make up the New England area, and Wisconsin. And that's really because our state is covered in forest, about 40% of our state. So we have 16 million acres of forest. We have this incredible geography and topography that creates fall colors literally like nowhere else in the country, minus maybe the New England area. And we're far more affordable.
Well, let's stick with the leaves. When are the best times to see leaves in different parts of the state this year?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question because every year, no matter how much science we're given, it's never a science. You know, a good rainfall could absolutely change the game. So what we have at the Department of Tourism is at travelwisconsin.com, you're going to find the fall color report. And you can click on the county or the city that you're interested in, and literally 100 reporters that volunteer around the state update this site daily. And what's interesting is you'd think it would change colors from north to south, but right now, really central Wisconsin is changing before the upper part of the state. So it's a great tool. Not only will it let you know, hey, it's at 45% color right now, or it's about to peak so you don't miss it. It will also let you know what's going on that weekend, where you can dine, where you can stay, and you can even take your photo once you get there. Download it to travelwisconsin.com and share it with the worldwide community.
Right, and it looks like there was already a smattering, let's say, of counties that were experiencing some beginning fall color, but where are we at overall?
Right now, I would say, you know, I would say most of the state is at about 5 to 10%. The biggest right now is in Hurley at 45% and Clark County at 35%. But a lot of folks are about 5 and 10%, and that's it. So I think it's going to be, you know, weather holding. It should be a beautiful fall.
Well, assuming we get the timing right, can you hit us with some good bike tours or fall drives we can take to make the most of it?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the granddaddy of them all is the Great River Road National Scenic Byway. And we're so proud of that because a couple years back, it was voted prettiest scenic drive in America by the readers of the Huffington Post. And it was cool because it beat out Hawaii's big highway, California's big highway. But, I mean, it's 250 miles along the mighty Mississippi with limestone bluffs and these gorgeous trees, you know, overreaching the highway at times on atop the bluff. It is magnificent. But I'm a big believer in Wisconsin's scenic byways, and we've got three state scenic byways. One, I think, is probably the coolest, shortest drive. When you take Door County Scenic Highway 42, you get near the part where you're at the end of the peninsula about to go on the ferry across to Washington Island, and you'll find the Jens Jensen Road. And that road, Jens Jensen is really a renowned architect and designer and planner, and he wanted people to slow down and not miss their life and not miss scenery. So he created a road that's almost going as it goes straight, left to right, left to right. And you almost don't believe it's a road in Wisconsin. So if you've never done the Jens Jensen Road on Highway 42, put it on your list, and I think you'll be sending me a thank you note.
We're talking with Stephanie Klett right now, Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Tourism. We're getting a jump on fall so we can figure out where we're going to go, what we're going to see, and what we're going to eat. And let's talk about that last part for a bit, Stephanie. The fall harvest, foods in Wisconsin, what should we be looking forward to, and where should we go?
Okay, well, where you should go, I mean, this is cranberry time. And so we'll combine an event with a harvest. And that's this weekend is the Warren's Cranberry Festival. And it's the largest cranberry festival in the world. You know, the town of Warren's population 300 hosts 100,000 visitors starting September 25th through the 27th. But it's everything cranberry you can think of. Cranberry pie, cranberry cream puffs, cranberry wine, cranberry beer, cranberry juice, craisins. It's deep-fried cranberries on a stick. It's cranberry cream cheese pie. I mean, it is incredible. So when I think of fall, I used to think immediately pumpkins and squash, and now it's cranberries all the way. And the other thing that I hope people think of when they think of fall is beef. And this is not so traditional, but Minocqua every year for over five decades has hosted Beef-a-Rama. And I think it's one of the most energetic, unusual, fun festivals that you can experience. It's just one day. It's happening this Saturday. And literally the whole community comes together and they have these grills and they grill a rump roast and they're judged on it. So then they take these rump roasts and there's probably 60, 70 of them. And they dress their rump roast up after it's been judged. And they'll put feather boas on it. I know the funeral parlor or funeral home in town put their roast in a little casket. And they roll it down for the parade of beef. It's an actual parade with all these roast beefs lined up. And it's the most surreal thing you'll ever see. So for me, it's not fall without Beef-a-Rama.
Still trying to conceptualize the cranberry cream puff, but we'll go to a caller. We've got Jackie on the line in Drummond. Jackie, hi.
Oh, yes, this is pretty exciting. I'm just driving along, pulling over to the side of the road. I was just thinking we have four events in the Hayward Cable area. So I'll start in Hayward. On Saturday, they have their Fall Fest. And then also in Cable, we have our Fall Fest, along with an antique car show. And then there's also the Berkey Trail Run, which is a 5K half marathon and an ultra marathon. And people can still register for that by going online to the American Birkebeiner, and you'll find your application there. And then I was just thinking there is probably the seventh annual library bicycle ride in Hayward. And you get to experience all the back roads of the Hayward area, and the distances go from 13 miles up to a century.
Jackie, thanks a lot for bringing those up. A lot going on in Hayward and Cable. And Stephanie, can you make the case for just finding out about your local area fall festivals?
Oh, sure, absolutely. For making the case or just how to get there?
Well, no, just to get out and enjoy them. I think a lot of people just let them pass them by.
Oh, you know, and we do. You know, and just about everybody's guilty of it. Take time, because otherwise, you know, next thing you know, doesn't it feel like, wow, is summer really over and now we're going into fall? If you don't take that time to do it, it's not coming back to you. You lose it forever. Make the commitment to it, because really when you do, one, fall is, I think, the best time to travel in the state. The crowds are just a little bit less. The festivals are still world class, but it's a time that you create memories with family and friends. You know, your creativity soars because you're giving yourself a break. And you really are, when you travel, even in your own backyard, you're your best self. I find when I travel, I become a better version of myself. And I think that's true for so many people.
And we started off by talking about the leaves, and it's a wonderful thing to drive through them. It's also lovely to get out and walk amongst them and hear them crunching under your feet. Do you have any recommendations for ideal fall trails where we can really make the most of that leaf season?
Oh, my goodness. You know what? We have so many phenomenal state parks here, so I would put up just about any state park. And for the first time ever, I discovered Lapham Peak State Park in the southern unit of the Kettle Moraine last weekend. And if you are a hiker, it is magnificent, and they have beginning trails, intermediate, and truly advanced trails. So, I mean, you will get a workout. They call it Roller Coaster Hill. There's seven of them in a row. But it's lush. It's thick. You'll see the kettles and the moraine. And it's just one of those places that makes you say, wow. Interstate Park is another great park, our oldest state park in Wisconsin, over 105 years old. It's got that jaw-dropping scenery that, you know, you look at it and it makes you proud to be from our state. And with the bluffs, with the water, and with the magnitude of forest around you, it's just one of those places that's a wow. So you can't go wrong going to any of our state parks or state natural areas.
What are we doing here on the phone? Let's get out there. Stephanie, thank you so much as always. Great time talking to you.
Thank you, Veronica. Thank you, Rob.
That was Stephanie Klett, Secretary of Wisconsin's Department of Tourism, with us to talk about fall tourism in the state a day before the fall equinox.
Well, thank you so much for your thoughts there. You can keep the conversation going on the Central Time Facebook page. Just search Central Time on WPR.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. The intersection between politicians and music is long, and it's muddled. Frankie Sullivan from Survivor was ticked off that Mike Huckabee and same-sex marriage opponent Kim Davis used Eye of the Tiger at rallies.
And some Springsteen fans were vocally unhappy when the boss talked politics back at a John Kerry presidential campaign rally. Add to the list of disgruntled musicians R.E.M., the Talking Heads, Neil Young. But who's got the law on their side, the musicians or the politicians?
Here to talk us through it is David Graham. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers U.S. politics and global news. David, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start off with the boss. Now, a lot of love has come to Bruce Springsteen from politicians, from Chris Christie, John Kerry, and Reagan advisor George Will.
That's right.
So now that song, it seems like kind of a Rorschach blot. What kinds of different things do people hear in it, depending on their political persuasion?
Yeah, well, you know, Springsteen's song, I think, if you read the lyrics, is fairly clearly a kind of bitter rumination on the plight of the working class in the mid-'80s. You know, complaining about a working guy can't get ahead, even if he's born in the USA. But you've got this great moment when George Will went to a Springsteen concert, apparently not paying attention to the lyrics very closely, and thought, oh, well, this is just great patriotic music. You know, he's really in the sort of Reagan-esque American spirit.
And Bruce Springsteen in particular has bounced back and forth. As you say, it was used there. Chris Christie, a big Bruce Springsteen fan, but not vice versa, I guess, always. How has the boss played out with different politicians then since then?
I mean, Springsteen, I think, over the course of his career has gone from being somebody who wrote songs that were somewhat political to being really very involved in politics. So you saw him out playing a series of concerts in benefit of John Kerry in 2004, and he appeared at campaign events with Barack Obama during his campaigns. And so he's really become a political player. But it's interesting because he does have this appeal, really, that is not so much political. And I think a lot of folks were attracted to his music without thinking about the political connotations. So you get somebody like Chris Christie, who just loves Springsteen, really a Springsteen super fan, but doesn't really agree with him about many things political.
Now, more recently, Donald Trump and Ted Cruz used REM for their anti-Iran deal at a rally in Washington. Here's a listen to that.
It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world.
With that one.
So this is another case where, you know, R.E.M. actually, I saw R.E.M. playing on the same tour with Springsteen in 2004. You know, they're a fairly liberal band politically, but Trump and Cruz used this the song at their anti-Iran deal rally, and R.E.M. struck back. They tweeted and issued a statement saying, you know, we don't approve of this, we disagree politically, but also saying, you know, we should focus on more important things than our politics, I guess.
And Michael Stipe of R.E.M. got pretty saucy with his response. We can't actually read it on the air without getting fined substantially. But is it common for musicians to be that outspoken when their songs get used by a politician with whom they don't agree?
I think we get a few of these every election cycle. Stipe's maybe is a little bit more on the extreme side of things. But, you know, Neil Young was pretty saucy when Donald Trump used Rockin' in the Free World. David Byrne sued Charlie Crist, who was then the governor of Florida, for using a song of his without permission. Jackson Brown condemned John McCain for using a song. So you get these things every now and then, almost always a case of a Republican politician using something and a liberal-leaning musician getting upset about it.
So who's got the right of way on this, David? Is it the politicians or is it the musician who created that music?
So the rules are a little bit vague, and it's tough to tell. Here's the general rule. If the people playing the song have a license from ASCAP or BMI, the major licensing organizations to play recorded music, which most, say, convention centers do, they're probably in the clear. You know, they've bought the right to this music, and the musicians can object, and they can make a stir about it and try to convince the politician that it's not worth the trouble. But legally, it's in the clear. Now, there are gradations. So, like, if a politician starts using a song so much that it starts to be viewed as their theme song, then the artist tends to have more rights, and they can say, your repeated use of this song implies that I have endorsed you, I disagree, and I want you to cease and desist. In that case, there could potentially be a successful lawsuit, although you don't often get a situation where that actually goes to a suit. Usually the politician will just quit using the song.
Talking to David Graham from The Atlantic about music and politics. So what happens when a candidate, say a presidential candidate, uses a song that the musician didn't want them to use? Maybe they disagree, and the kerfluffle that can come out of that sort of thing. So, David, yeah, you mentioned a lot of times the politician will just drop it, because one story a politician doesn't want to read about themselves in the media is some argument over their use of music. David?
Musician bashing you in the press, and you just don't want to be distracted from the everyday business of politics, I guess.
Well, and part of your argument about this whole thing is that once the song is born, that is, a musician creates it and releases it out to the world, that maybe it sort of belongs to everybody, and the musician shouldn't be sort of sitting on the shoulder of the song trying to say when it can and cannot be used.
Yeah, I think it's a tough question for an artist. You know, on the one hand, I understand where they're coming from. They have strong views, and they tend to come at these things from a perspective, and it's their baby. On the other hand, you know, at some point you have to let go and give those rights up. I think it's an interesting case because you get a division between a song like It's the End of the World as We Know It, which doesn't, to me, have any particular meaning or political connotation, versus a song like Rockin' in the Free World by Neil Young, which is really a pretty angry song about the state of things in the late 80s, and implicitly blasts George H.W. Bush. That's a case where if a politician who disagrees with Neil Young uses the song, it tends to make the politician look kind of dumb, and I in that case I say, if I was an artist, I would want to, you know, give him enough rope and let them take it from there.
Well, all the songs we're talking about, and you point this out in your piece, of Born in the USA, Eye of the Tiger, Rockin' in the Free World, these haven't seen the light of a Billboard chart in a few decades. So what does that tell us? That these fights are mostly over older songs.
Yeah, you would think that the people in charge of programming music could find some interesting anthemic songs from more recently that would do the trick. Maybe what this tells us is that most voters tend toward the aging end of the scale. Boomers are a very important ad demographic and voter demographic compared to millennials, and so those are the people you want to play music for.
And you talked about this just a little bit earlier, and you said that most of this is the more liberal-leaning politics of musicians clashing with more conservative politics of politicians. Does it ever go the other direction?
You know, I tried to find a good example of one that goes the other way, and there aren't a great deal. You do get conservative musicians, and I think the two most prominent examples in recent years are Kid Rock, who appeared at Romney events and whose song became a Romney theme, and Ted Nugent, who's spoken on behalf of several Republican candidates for office. But I think the thing is that Democratic politicians don't really feel any need to play Ted Nugent. There's no cultural signifier that goes the same way. And they're kind of pigeonholed musicians, I think, because of their views, particularly Nugent. Whereas someone like R.E.M. has pretty wide appeal, and people don't think of R.E.M. as a political band with any particular cultural baggage.
It just popped into my head. I remember hearing an interview with Randy Bachman of Bachman Turner Overdrive, Canadian musician. Al Gore used his song You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet, which content-wise is a little weird for a presidential campaign. But Randy Bachman said, I object to them using it not because I disagree. I would vote for Gore, maybe, he said, if I were American, but because I'm not getting my royalties on this. But so does a musician actually get royalties every time a politician plays their song?
So in theory, they should be getting royalties from ASCAP or BMI from these licensing agreements. You know, a venue or a campaign or whomever can buy a license to use recorded music, and then it's basically a bulk license, and then from there the royalties should be going to the artist. What you get is sometimes that doesn't work. Sometimes agreements don't happen. In the case of a battle between David Byrne of Talking Heads and Charlie Crist a few years ago, Crist had used the music in a video and just had never paid for it. And what Byrne said was that he discovered in the course of sort of pursuing this that this is really frequent. All the time politicians are using music in videos and not paying for it. And it was just that he had the wherewithal and the energy to go after Crist for it.
Now, going back to Chris Christie from New Jersey, he was, as you said, the super fan of Bruce Springsteen, also from New Jersey, but Springsteen not so much on board with Christie's politics. And it sounds like Christie sort of defected a little, turned to somebody else. He turned to Bon Jovi, which is an interesting case point in politics and music. What happened?
So, yeah, I mean, Chris Christie just loves Springsteen. He's talked about this over the years. He gave a long interview to my colleague Jeffrey Goldberg for a story about, you know, why he loves Springsteen and what his favorite Springsteen songs were. Recently, somebody turned up old posts from web forums where he was writing about Springsteen shows. But Springsteen has little time for Christie and just disagrees with him on many issues. It's right, Christie has started using songs by Bon Jovi, who is also a prominent New Jersey musician. He's also a Democrat, but he's friends with Chris Christie, and in a statement about this, he said, "My friendships are apolitical," which is an interesting viewpoint.
Do you think we'll see more of that in the election?
More of the apolitical thing, or more
musicians? Right, musicians being a little more accommodating, because we're getting into the thick of it. More of that music's going to be out there.
Oh, I suspect it'll actually get more frequent. You know, as we get into it and more people are paying attention and the lines are drawn, I think musicians are going to be even touchier about this and they'll be paying closer attention.
David, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
David Graham is a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers U.S. politics and global news. He was previously politics editor at The Atlantic and a reporter for Newsweek. He was talking with us there about what happens when musicians object to politicians using their songs on the campaign trail.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. As we heard yesterday, Governor Scott Walker is officially out of the presidential race.
Today, I believe that I'm being called to lead by helping to clear the field in this race so that a positive conservative message can rise to the top of the field. With this in mind, I will suspend my campaign immediately.
Coming up in a bit, we'll look at what this means for Wisconsin. First, a look at the presidential campaign itself. After a strong start at the top of the polls in Iowa, Governor Walker had been steadily dropping both in state and national surveys, bottoming out under 1% in the latest CNN national poll.
He also had a disappointing performance at the second presidential debate last week, speaking fewer minutes than any other candidate.
We're taking your calls. What did you think when you heard the news yesterday that Governor Walker was dropping out of the presidential race? How do you think this decision will affect other candidates? What do you think led to his decline in the Republican presidential field? And if you're a Republican voter yourself, who is your attention turning to now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Charlie Jacobs is with us now to talk about the news. He's an associate professor of political science at St. Norbert College. Charlie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So what was your first reaction when you heard that Governor Walker was going to hold this press conference? Did you expect then that this was the big announcement for him?
I suspect everyone did, although I think there was probably a little suspicion in everyone's mind that it was maybe something else, only because I think it came as quite a shock and surprise to most people. I think when you saw his performance in the debate, when you heard him speak, while you understood he was slipping in the polls, you didn't think at this early date, after sort of laying the groundwork that he did, that he'd pull the plug before a single vote being cast in any primary. So I think everybody might have thought there was another announcement, but really probably in their gut felt this is going to be the end for his campaign.
Well, that is something people are scratching their heads about, that pulling out before there was a single vote cast. Now, it sounds like there's a large financial factor there, but does this make sense to you that the governor pulled out? You know, here's a three-time Republican winner in a blue state, one-time front runner. We all know that presidential politics are capricious. Did he get out of the race too soon? Could he have stayed alive somehow?
Well, he could have stayed alive somehow. I mean, you're watching some of the candidates that are still plying the waters here of the GOP primary process doing it on a shoestring, and I suppose he could have done that as well. But I think when you come out of the gate sort of full of vim and vigor and going like gangbusters and creating a large infrastructure for your campaign, dialing it back to a shoestring budget is rather difficult, and I think you might be doing a disservice to yourself and really having creating difficulties for yourself to raise money if you get stuck in that kind of cycle. So it may have been sort of an imprudent kind of approach to his campaign if he had been a little bit more cautious coming out of the gate, that he might have been able to sort of limp through till Iowa, maybe win enough caucus votes to guarantee a shot at New Hampshire and then move on. But I think the way it was structured, his campaign was structured, he didn't really have many options once the well of donations kind of dry up on him.
He had, as I hear, 90 staffers. He came out of the gate really big, really large with that operation. In retrospect, a mistake?
Probably. And I think this is one of the new dynamics of modern presidential politics. It used to be that you could kind of have a quiet campaign and build support among all of the political players and elites in a particular state, raise some money, have a campaign organization, but one that's kind of slim and can do the job for you. And unfortunately today, it seems like everybody has to run a national campaign from the moment they come out. And it's impossible to have that kind of money and sustain it over time unless you have a really deep well of resources. So somebody like Trump, somebody like Bush, they either have connections or personal wealth. And while Governor Walker has some connections, you know, you have to raise money on two fronts now, the super PACs and your traditional campaign. And if you service one rather than the other, you can put yourself in real trouble.
Now, speaking of a deep well, it did seem that Walker was well-funded, maybe not to Trumpian proportions, but he had a very well-funded super PAC. So what does that say about super PACs in politics?
Well, super PACs can be really beneficial, but they can also, I think, be really harmful. And, you know, these are relatively new vehicles. I mean, they kind of were born out of a couple of Supreme Court decisions that we had, 2009, 2010. People are probably familiar with Citizens United. And so, you know, these were born of those decisions. And super PACs allow individuals to raise money, but it has to be independent of their campaign. And that's one of the things about super PACs that's a little bit squirrely. So they're actually called, sort of by law, independent expenditure only committees, and that's their formal name. We call them super PACs. They can raise unlimited money. They can spend unlimited money. But the problem is they have to spend it independent of the campaign. It's not buying plane tickets. It's not buying staffers. It's only advocating for the election of a particular candidate. So you have to raise money independently for a campaign to do all of those day-to-day functions. And so even though he has this big pool of money, this $20 million in the bank, it can only be used for limited purposes, and again, independent from the campaign. So he'd have to go out and raise money to keep those staffers, you know, paid, and he'd have to raise independent money in order to keep his campaign going in Iowa, New Hampshire, and other states as well. So it looks like he had a lot of money, but it's money you can't touch. It's kind of like a weird trust fund that kids can't get to until they hit a certain age.
Well, so for critics of super PACs, people who wring their hands over it and say that this is tilting the political landscape into a position which is not fair to all candidates, does this undercut that argument that maybe it's not as compelling an argument in favor of a candidate as maybe just a well-grounded general campaign?
I think that, again, the jury's out still a little bit on the way these can be used, are used, how they're beneficial. I think what this one case is illustrating is that super PACs alone aren't going to win you a primary and probably aren't going to win you an election. You need a broad base of donors who are going to support your overall campaign. So if you have a sugar daddy or a sugar mama who's pumping money into your super PAC, well, they can only give a limited amount of money to your general election fund. And so you've got to make sure that you have a broad base of supporters who are going to throw some dollars your way. So somebody like Bernie Sanders, if you look at the money he has been collecting, it's been those small donors. No Koch brothers involved, just all those small donors. And those can be really effective on the ground when you have to campaign. And certainly $20 million in the bank so you can run a bunch of ads, or at least your super PAC can run ads in support of you, help to pull money away from what you need to spend in your own campaign fund. But, you know, I don't know if somebody like Bush is going to be able to spend the $100 million that his campaign has accrued in its super PAC. That's a lot of money, and I'm not sure how well that's going to go towards helping him get elected in the GOP primary.
We're talking with Charlie Jacobs, Associate Professor of Political Science at St. Norbert College, talking about Governor Walker's early exit from the race and what it means for the rest of the Republican field going forward. Here's a little bit about what the governor said yesterday.
I encourage other Republican presidential candidates to consider doing the same so that the voters can focus on a limited number of candidates who can offer a positive conservative alternative to the current front runner.
Okay, so now that Walker's out, we're at, what, 15? This is not exactly a tiny field, but will that statement, that sentiment of maybe starting to winnow this field down so that a front runner, maybe an alternative to Trump, if you're Scott Walker, that's what you want, maybe that person can emerge. Is that going to be an argument people listen to?
I don't think it's going to be an argument that candidates listen to. I mean, the public might be more focused in exactly what they're paying attention to in the debates and trying to choose among the various candidates. But, you know, there still are a number of candidates with relatively large storehouses of cash that they can spend on their campaigns. So I think most of them are going to stick it out. At least we'll have to see with the October filings with the Federal Elections Commission how much money these people have on hand. But, you know, Jeb Bush in his last filing had over $10 million to spend. Ted Cruz had about $8.5 million. Marco Rubio had $10 million. So I don't see any of those individuals dropping out anytime soon. I mean, Rick Perry dropped out. He had less than $1 million on hand on his last filing. And, that, I mean, that's problematic. And I think that's what Governor Walker was facing. We'll see when the FEC reports come out. But unless somebody is in dire straits like apparently Walker was, I don't see them hanging it up, especially if they've been able to get by on limited amount of funding in the campaign they've run already.
And it is super early in the season. It's worth pointing that out. But with so many candidates in field, with so many of them having those deep pockets, as you say, I know it's early to speculate, but how do you see this thing ending? How does it get winnowed down?
I don't think deep pockets is enough, and you've already started to see the way in which these candidates are bouncing around. If they wind up being the flavor of the day because they perform particularly well at a debate or they had a nice performance at a particular event, say the one in Michigan last weekend or something on a national television program, I mean, these tend to raise and lower the expectations of the public and the way in which they view the candidates. So I don't see deep pockets necessarily being the only factor. It just means that some marginal candidates might stay in a bit longer because they have money to spend and money to blow on the campaign. But when you start to drop in the polls, as happened to Governor Walker, it's really hard to get people to come to your campaign events and sustain the donations that will keep you moving through the process. I mean, Governor Walker indicated, or at least some of his aides indicated, he was having trouble filling the rooms for his fundraising events. And that really starts to ring the bell on the end of your campaign.
We're talking to political scientist Charlie Jacobs about the news that Governor Walker is dropping out, has dropped out, in fact, of the presidential race.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reaction to that news yesterday. Were you surprised by Governor Walker dropping out? What candidate do you think will get Walker's supporters? And if you are a Republican voter yourself, were you disappointed or do you think there's a stronger candidate in the field? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our discussion now with political scientist Charlie Jacobs talking about Governor Walker's decision to drop out of the presidential race. That happened yesterday.
We're taking your calls now. How do you think Governor Walker's exit will affect the other candidates? Who gets Governor Walker's supporters and maybe his support down the road? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our callers now. We've got Jenny with us in Williams Bay. Jenny, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
I was pretty happy when he dropped out of the race. I live in Wisconsin, obviously. I didn't vote for him, but I did vote for getting him out of the office, which didn't work, to recall him. He put a bunch of families against each other here because of the union bash. And if he were elected president, I'm pretty sure he'd do it at the federal level, too.
And Jenny, how would you identify yourself? How do you usually vote?
I have voted for Republican or Democrat, mostly Republican. I'll be voting for Ben Carson. So I hope everybody else who was going to vote for Walker will go for Carson, too.
All right. Why do you suggest that move, throwing support behind Carson?
He's definitely a Republican, same lines as Scott Walker, but Ben Carson doesn't adhere to the party as much as it seemed like Scott Walker was doing. He's going to listen to the people more than Scott Walker would have.
Okay, so you see him as a little bit more of an independent thinker then, is that what I'm hearing?
Totally, yes.
All right, Jenny, thank you so much for that. Appreciate your thoughts on that. And Charlie, Jenny usually votes Republican. She's going to be voting and putting her support at least behind Ben Carson. Do you think that's something that others will do too?
Well, I'm not sure about that. I think that much of Governor Walker's support that has left him already was probably looking for something they couldn't find in Walker himself. And so those who have sustained support for him probably liked his relatively moderate Republicanism. I know that he does sort of tilt right on a number of issues, but he's kind of a standard Republican, and his ideology is one that he promotes himself as a Reaganite, and that's sort of very central, middle-of-the-road kind of Republicanism. So I think the people who have stuck with him will probably look for someone like him, and I'm thinking maybe a Kasich or Rubio, someone like that, and maybe even somebody with sort of Midwestern sensibilities, and that's why Kasich kind of popped to mind. I mean, Carson, I think, is someone who's viewed more of an outsider, more of a maverick and independent, kind of like Jenny was articulating. And so I'm not sure whether or not they're going to dump with somebody like Walker, or, you know, leave his campaign now that he's left it, and latch on to somebody like Ben Carson, who seems a little bit different from what Walker was presenting.
Well, thank you for your call, Jenny. And we're going to go next to Tom in Madison. Tom, hi.
Good afternoon. The operative word in Jenny's call was thinking. And I believe that Walker is simply inane and vapid. This guy should not even be in the governor's office, let alone even considering a presidential run.
Tom, thank you for the call. And Charlie, I want to ask you about Walker's call to, it sounded like, get people to mount an offensive against Donald Trump, the front runner. He referenced the front runner, nobody by name. And there was some polling to suggest that maybe Walker would actually have been a pretty decent choice for someone to take on Trump. What have you heard about that?
Well, I mean, unfortunately, we will never know. I think, as you mentioned at the start, you know, he hardly spoke at all in the second debate. It wasn't much better in the first debate. And unfortunately, the arguments that the candidates themselves would have, they never really engaged in substantive issues. I mean, they would sort of skirt them. They'd throw out a couple of talking points. But sort of taking them on in a real in-depth, substantive way never really happened. And unfortunately for Walker, I think, is that he kind of got stuck in an endless loop of talking about some issues that were of concern of his and of Wisconsinites, but may not have really reflected what the public wanted to hear nationwide. And so we got the union issues, we got some regurgitation of Obamacare issues, and so I think that was a problem. And so when Trump would sort of wander off on one of his tirades on sort of a tangential issue, Walker would kind of come back and loop back to standard issues that he was accustomed and comfortable to talking about. So I'm not sure whether or not he would have really engaged someone like Trump, because Trump was kind of a loose cannon.
Talking to Charlie Jacobs right now, associate professor of political science at St. Norbert College, we're talking about what Walker's dropping out of the race means for the rest of the Republican field. And we'll go next to Barbara joining us in Iron River, Michigan. Barbara, hi.
Hi. So you want to know what I think. I think that Governor Walker, he joined the race late because he was not wanting to record who was donating to him. And people may forget that you don't have to tell who's giving you money until you actually finally run for something. So finally he did, and he had huge donors and super PAC, and then the numbers didn't roll in the polls. And so as soon as they figured out that he wasn't going to be the candidate, they probably pulled out, which is smart. And I wouldn't be surprised if they are supporting Fiorina now.
Okay, interesting. Barbara, thank you for your call. Appreciate your thoughts there. And what do you think about that, Charlie? People moving toward Fiorina and those donors leaving the flock early, do you think?
I mean, I think Barbara makes a really, really good point because, of course, you can raise money for an associated super PAC even if you haven't announced your run for presidency. But under federal law, you can only start really collecting significant amounts of money for your election campaign until you declare. Federal law allows you to raise some money to sort of do an exploratory, but until you announce, you can't really pick up those funds. And the longer he waited, the harder it was going to be for him to have money in the bank to actually run the campaign. I mean, it's only been about 70 days or so since he's announced, so it makes it really difficult. As to the Fiorina issue, I mean, I think she's an outsider, too. I think she's got the same kind of reputation as Ben Carson. I will say in the second debate, she was among the few who was really clear in articulating what her policy positions were. Again, in the short amount of time she had, but she was very focused. She had clear, comprehensible answers. I think I've mentioned before that I felt like she was almost reading off a teleprompter, that she was so well rehearsed, but at the same time it didn't sound rehearsed. So maybe individuals like that forcefulness. I mean, Walker got kudos when he went to Iowa in January, and he sounded charismatic and forceful and as though he had an agenda that he could promote. And maybe that does attract people to Fiorina because that's how she came off in the last debate.
Well, Barbara, thanks for that. We're going to go next to Rose in Milwaukee. Hi, Rose.
Hello.
Hi, what do you think?
I am thrilled that Walker dropped out of the race, and as much as I don't agree with him on many issues, I am a moderate Republican, have always voted Republican, and actually, just due to the candidates in the last gubernatorial race, voted for Walker because he was the lesser of the two evils. I'm excited that he dropped out to make way for stronger candidates, because I think when it comes down to it is we have to look to the future and see who the Republicans are going to be up against. Is it going to be Hillary, Bernie, or will it be Joe Biden? And quite frankly, I just don't think Walker had it at all.
Now, Rose, right now the field has been tilting toward anti-establishment Republican candidates. Is that also how you're thinking right now?
You know, currently I have Carly Fiorina as number one on my list, with Ben Carson falling closely behind, and both of them are, you know, definitely not in the political sphere, never have been. But Carly Fiorina said something really, really telling in a recent interview. I believe it was on Sunday, and she addressed that head on, as she always has. She's so articulate, and as your guest has said, it's almost like she's reading off a teleprompter because her answers are so clear, concise, well-researched, and she answers right away. But she addressed that by saying that, you know, politicians, not all politicians are evil or have malicious, you know, intent. But they've been in that pool for such a long time that in some way they just can't see anything else. It's like being a fish in a school of fish in the same water all the time. You just don't know anything else. But her bringing an outside view of not being in that water in the Disneyland that is Washington, she can bring a fresh view and something that's realistic. And when she talked about how she's a breast cancer survivor, she lost a child to drug abuse. I mean, she's bringing real world experience, not only from her experience as the head of HP, but just her experience as being a human, as being a mother, as being a wife who's gone through some very challenging and tragic events in her own life. And I connect with her. She's a real person.
Rose, thank you so much for your call. I appreciate you sharing your thoughts with us. A couple things there. She's also talking about the poise of Fiorina, her real world experience, and Scott Walker making way for candidates like Fiorina. Is that the case? Does one candidate dropping out of such a big field really make space for anyone else?
I'm not sure it does. I don't think that Scott Walker had sort of a corner on the market of any element of the debate that's going on among the GOP candidates right now. So I don't think somebody's going to swoop in and try to take control of that field. But I think it does sort of start to loosen up some of the discussion that the candidates are going to have, the fewer and fewer there are at the table. The other thing is that as we get fewer and fewer people because the field winnows a bit, we're going to see those who are asking the questions at debates and pressing these candidates on issues focus more narrowly. So I think Carly Fiorina, although she did a wonderful job at the last debate, she is probably going to be the red meat that people go after in the next one. So if she got by on sort of luck and charisma in the last one, she better be prepared because I think they're going to go after her like they went after Trump at the last one. So we'll have to see how well these candidates do on their feet. And maybe she'll do wonderfully and replicate her second debate performance. But we'll have to see how this goes. And
Charlie, we got to leave it there, but thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Charlie Jacobs, Associate Professor of Political Science at St. Norbert College. He joined us to talk about Governor Walker's press conference yesterday, where he announced he was suspending his campaign for president.